Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2Jet. I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Malen, KG2C, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of the website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to live.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is available on our website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Malen KG2C will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. Last month, we did something a little different. We offered a pair of presentations on several aspects of software-defined radios and answered questions about them afterwards. These discussions are available in our archive. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let me know either here or use our email address, tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net tonight, Malen KG2C. Good evening, Malen.
Good evening, Roy. This is Milan, QGolf 2 Charlie from Briarwood in Queens. Looking forward to tonight's net, and I really enjoyed the SDR net last month. I learned a couple useful things, and I'm sure I will learn more things this coming year anymore. It is 2018. So back to you, Roy, from QGolf 2 Charlie.
Very good. Thank you very much, Milan. So I will now open this session of our technical net for people to throw out their call signs with either questions or comments for the net. So please give me your call sign and your name.
Net Control. Net Control. This is radio station Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo, Joe in Gravesend, Brooklyn, New York, supporting the net.
Thank you, Joe. Is there anyone who would like to give their call sign for a question or a comment for the technical net tonight? Please ask away.
Net Control. Net Control, KC2WTA, Joe in Staten Island with questions.
Very good, Joe recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? I do promise one of these days I will get that cricket sound effect, but before that, once again, does anyone out there have any questions or comments that they want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, once again, though, keep in mind that there is a TechNet puzzle for tonight. It's a relatively simple one. It's all in words. There's no pretty pictures, and it shouldn't be difficult. There's no tricks involved. So if you have a chance, look at it in the website, puzzle.kc2rc.com. Or use that little orange-yellowish link on the front page and take a look. So I guess we'll go first with Joe, KC2WTA. Good evening, Joe, and what can we ponder today?
Good evening, Roy and Malen and the other station that checked in supporting. Thank you for supporting. I just wanted to ask a question about software-defined radio. But I see, Roy, I don't have the puzzle on the website. I see the TechNet puzzle for December 27th, but I don't see this issue's puzzle.
Well, let me play with my web browser for 1 second, and I'll get back to you, and I'll tell you if I have it or if I set up the link a little bit wrong. But I'll be right back.
Roy, just so you know, when I went through puzzle, it did take me to it, and a few days ago, at least, when I went through the website link, I also went through it. Now, maybe it's a caching problem that he has, but I also sent you an email about a mark next to one of the answers that I don't think should be there. Maybe you want to remove it while you're at it. Kilogolf to Charlie.
Okay, 1 sec. Let me do some magic here. Oh, this is interesting. I was able to go through the alias. When I went through the main thing, it doesn't seem to be loading for me right now. I don't know. There might be a problem with the actual website.
Okay, Doc. Well, if it's just a word puzzle.
This is the one with the current puzzle, and it loads for me just fine right now.
You can read it out for us.
Yeah, let's just do it that way. I'll figure out what went wrong with the website. Sometimes it goes offline. The question is relatively simple. The question is, overdriving a power amplifier will, A, give you a high standing wave ratio, B, give you a minimum distortion on receive, C, generate excessive harmonics, and D, maximize the power output. So those are the four choices of overdriving a power amplifier. And most people should kind of have an idea of why we shouldn't overdrive our power amplifiers, because it's always possible to increase the amplification gain of any circuit, but there's a price to be paid. And we'll discuss the price later on during the TechNet.
Okay, right. Before I ask, we've been on for a little bit. Before I ask my question, do you want to put out a call for more call signs and questions?
Well, I think that we should kind of entertain your questions, and when we're done with yours, then I'll ask people, because people kind of slowly remember that, oh, yeah, it's Wednesday, oh, yeah, it's after 9. So, by the time we finish with our discussion, chances are there'll be a few more people coming around who hopefully will have a question. So give us your question.
Okay, Roy. What I came away with from the other discussions is that a software-defined radio can basically operate on just about any mode that you want, because it's the type of radio is defined by the software and not the physical arrangement of the components. And the other thing that I came away with is that software-defined radio has a little better receive sensitivity than the normal counterpart. Is that about right?
Well, yes. The beauty of software-defined radio is all of the demodulation is done using software. And so there is no circuitry required. So if you can figure out the algorithms of fiddling the bits, you can demodulate pretty much anything into understandable transmission. You can even theoretically do this with things like D-Star and DMR and Fusion. The little problem, though, is the code-decode algorithms for compressing it are patented and not published. And so, unfortunately, the information to play with the bits isn't available to the public, and so can't be software re-engineered without kind of getting a knock on the door from a lawyer. But that's exactly one of the major benefits of software-defined radio, that if someone comes up with a new demodulation scheme next Wednesday, the software-defined radio that you bought a year ago is not obsolete. It can be reprogrammed to include that as well. And as far as the other features, the ultimate ceiling to the specs are usually much better than analog, but it depends upon how much money is spent on the silicon and the programmer, whether you can reach that higher limit or not. It is unfortunately possible to have a lousy software-defined radio if it costs very little, is kind of old-grade silicone, and the programming is kind of iffy. So you have greater abilities, but you also have the limitations of the humanity.
Okie doke. As you know, I'm building an all vacuum tube-based HeatherKit station, and I'm going to have two receivers with set up vertically and horizontally for diversity of reception. I was wondering what the practical use of SDR might be for me in the new station in terms of getting a better receive signal.
Well, again, it sort of depends upon the radio and the software and other factors. Now, one thing that some software-defined radios are capable of doing is different levels of what's called diversity reception, in that it can take the input of two different antennas and sometimes do not terribly interesting things with them, and in the case of some mature software, do a lot of very interesting things. Now, unfortunately, my lovely little Flex 6700, which operates on a program called Smart SDR, isn't really that smart as far as diversity. What it does for me for diversity is I can listen on one ear to the horizontal input and the other ear to the vertical input. Now, sometimes that's kind of fascinating, actually, because I still remember there was a gentleman down in Florida who had a big honking Yagi pointed at us here in Brooklyn, and he was experiencing what he described as fading in and fading out. I was listening to his signal, and I was able to tell that it wasn't exactly that it was fading in and out. What it was doing was apparently the ionosphere was acting in a very weird way and was rotating the polarization of his signal and probably mine. It went from horizontal to vertical to horizontal to vertical because it popped up in my left ear, then it faded and went into my right ear, and then back and forth. But because he had this big honking Yagi that was horizontally polarized and only horizontally polarized, he only really heard the horizontal component. And so to him, it was simply fading in and out. Now, better software, and hopefully smart SDR will improve along those lines, should be able to actually interpolate the phase relationship of the two signals and be able to know background noises and all kinds of things and add a great deal to the experience of being able to pick a signal out of the background noise. So that's what I'm looking forward to. There are older Flexes that have older software that's more mature that's actually capable of doing this. They have a phase diagram where they maneuver the phase relationships of the two signals for the optimum type of reception. And so that's what I think is going to be the future and will be probably very useful for you as well if it's implemented.
Yep. Okie doke. I once saw a YouTube presentation on the two analog radios working in diversity reception with a just a simple audio mixer mixing the signals. I haven't been able to find it again, but I may try something like that. But, a lot of this stuff, a lot of guys like me, when we start in this hobby, we start with junk, you know, which is what I started with. My two first rigs were Radio Shack rigs, the 2-meter rig and the 10-meter only rig. And then I bumped up on a 2-meter rig. I got a Yaesu and my high frequency. I got the Kenwood. And now I'm just trying to do this top of the line vintage setup with the HeatherKit. So if I were to go for an SDR today, what would you consider top shelf?
There's a question that probably causes more bar fights than anything in some avenues of amateur radio operating. I I like Flex Radio. I think the hardware is very well engineered, and I think that they are good when repairs need to be done. They're very on top of things, and they don't quibble and yell and scream and jump up and down and say that they need a shipping, a handling fee, or anything like that. The problem, unfortunately, presently with Flex Radio is they're kind of slow with upgrading the software. So I'm kind of stuck with a machine that could probably do 10 trillion different things. It's like a computer. Think of all the programs that you could possibly run on your computer. Now think of it as only one company that's not really that, has a lot of money and a lot of technicians and a lot of software engineers is the only guys writing programs for that computer. So it leaves you with a bad feeling, unfortunately, of so much potential that's unrealized. But when I look around the other major companies, there's Anan, there's Apache Labs, which is India. They basically just manufacture the Tucson amateur packet radio kits that they've been selling for a few years. They're very good quality. If you like Android phones and you like looking under the hood and setting all the little bits and pieces and finagling it up and down all time, then Apache Labs stuff would suit you. You can go on the HF bands, and there's a whole bunch of people adjusting every little parameter that's possible on that radio. With the Flex Radio, it's more like a iPhone or iPad. It's kind of all done for you, under the hood, hidden, and you don't have to worry about it. And then there are Europeans like Sun SDR, which are interesting boxes, but I don't know if I quite trust them. I don't know that much about the company and whether they'll be around tomorrow. They might. I don't know. Those, to me, are, I think, the three top. There's other little companies that mostly sell radio receivers, and they're testing the water with a transmitter. So that's like ELAD. And then you have ICOM, which is the first guys in Japan who are starting to develop software-defined radios. I tend to think they're kind of half-hearted. I mean, eventually they'll probably have a full blazes software-defined radio line. But right now, it's a little bit yes and a little bit no. And I don't know. I really like the fact that I have eight slices, eight virtual radio receivers, whereas ICOM just has two. And probably for the foreseeable future, they'll just be building radios with two receivers in them, because that's what a lot of the people who've been in this hobby for 20, 30 years are used to. And so Japanese companies tend to be a wee bit conservative, in my humble opinion. So that seems to be my look at the present state of the art as far as transmitters go. A lot more options with receivers, not that many options with transmitters. Let me throw it out to the audience and Milan or anyone else who's interested, who has any ideas, if I've left some transceiver company out. Once again, also, Elecraft KX3 theoretically is an early version of a software-defined radio. But anyway, let me open it up, and anyone who has any opinions of other software-defined transceivers, let it rip.
G2RY, good evening.
David, do you have anything to say about this particular thing?
I just had an experience. I was listening on the web SDR in northeastern Pennsylvania on my web browser, and I was transmitting, you know, with my transmitter. And, you know, strangely enough, since New York and Pennsylvania are far enough apart for 20 meters, I wouldn't hear myself transmitting. But, you know, when I was transmitting on 20 meters, I could also hear what was going on the channel while I was talking. It's very interesting.
Oh, yes. Web software-defined radios are a very useful feature. I know other people who have found it and use it to listen around, both to get a better idea of signals that aren't quite as clear as they'd like to be locally, or in some cases where the web SDR is based in an area, they can pick up their own signal, and then they could get an idea of what their signal is sounding like in that area. So, yes, other people are doing exactly what you're doing, David. They're utilizing the computer and web SDR, and there's some very nice guys out there who stick a lot of software-defined radio dongle receivers into their computer and allow as many as 40 different people to access them and listen on different frequencies at the same time. So it's a fascinating thing that's developing over time.
Yes, sir. And also, I have a very high noise floor on 40 meters, a 5 and 9, an S9 noise floor on 40 meters. So, you know, I listen on the web SDR because the noise is much less on their system. You know, I'm trying to figure out, like, what to do. I suspect it's, I can't think of the word to use. There's another antenna up there that's way too close to it, and it's eating up my 40 meter signal. Go ahead.
Okay, it might be local interference. It's also, you know, you're living in an urban environment where, you know, the same way that people who are into astronomy have a very bad time looking up at the stars in the metropolitan area because of all the light pollution, we're exposed to a great deal of electromagnetic pollution. So it's definitely, you know, there's a lot of less urban environments where the background noise is much lower. Now, in addition, if you have other contributing factors in your neighborhood that are just either distorting your reception parameters or introducing more noise into the whole thing, then that's very problematic. Once again, you know, something like a diversity reception with the ability to modify phase relationships might end up being useful. And there are multi-antenna devices out there where you set up multiple vertical antennas and hook them into phasing circuits. And by tweaking and adjusting the phase angle between them, sometimes you can null out the background noise. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to get around it, but one of the easier ways, I guess, is to just jump ship and go on the Internet and pick up the signal in a less urban environment.
So, but there's more to the story. The antenna works great on 10, 15, 17, and 20. 40 has got an S9 noise floor. Also, the signal that transmit, you know, is very weak, you know. But for a strange occurrence that the SWR is better than 1.5 to 1 on all the bands, including 40, where the signal is being eaten up. So, you know, I have an antenna I'm going to remove, you know, and see if it isn't. The problem is coupling, you know, antenna coupling, because the antenna is too close to each other. So if I take one away, you know, it might improve significantly 40 meters for me.
Okay, I mean, that's possible. As we've mentioned a few times in the past, standing wave ratio is very useful, very important, but it's not the totality of an antenna. All that the standing wave ratio tells you is the impedance factor of your antenna. You want an impedance for your antenna, which is approximately 50 ohms, so that the maximum amount of power will be transferred from your amplifier through your transmission line into your antenna, and they're radiated out into the world. But that's not the be-all, end-all. If you have an inefficient antenna, if it's a coupling with another piece of metal, if it's a signal is being blocked and or reflected, then it could be reflected in a negative way, then even though the impedance is perfect, if it was exactly 50 ohms, your signals would not be good. So there's more to it than standing wave ratio. And I would think that there's something in addition to coupling, something else going on, because coupling might explain the diminished efficiency of your transmission. It would not particularly explain the high amount of background noise. I would assume that there is something going on at 40 meters that's not going on at 20 and above that's getting messed up and getting inserted into your antenna. So there's probably a very high-level noise source that's distinctly in the 40-meter range.
Yeah, but it's strange. You know, I tell you, KG2RY, it also low noise on 160 meters, low noise on 20, 17, 15, and 10, but on 40 meters, S9. So I don't know. I'm going to have to do some investigation. But if I remove the antenna and the signal gets out better and there's at least some improvement in the noise, you know, then one of those, what do they call them, you know, the noise blanker, signal enhancer from MFJ, and they make them. I think they're called MFJ 1025, which, you know, you hook up another antenna and you phase out the noise. Go ahead.
Yes, that is what I was trying to explain about 5 minutes ago, that if you have two signals, sometimes you can invert the phase and remove the background noise. And once again, it's not incredibly odd that a noise source is a noise source for a specific small range of frequencies. All noise generators do not have to be uniform across the entire spectrum. You could have something that's just giving off a lot of power around 7 megahertz with very little component in the 3.5 megahertz and very little component in the 14 megahertz. And so you're seeing this enormous background noise on 40 meters without any of the other bands being affected. So I think it's much more likely that there's some kind of noise generation that's simply a narrow band approximately where 40 meters is.
QSL, Roy, would you recommend, you know, that I look, you know, around for metal sources, any kind of possible magnetic radiation from wires or metal objects, and try to keep the antenna as far away from them as possible? Go ahead.
AC2GS, by the way. Yes, I think it would be very effective if you were to take some kind of a small portable radio capable of receiving in the 40-meter band and taking a stroll around the neighborhood and especially around where your antenna is and see if you can figure out if there's a significant local emanation that's kind of burning up 40 meters. And then once you figure the direction, hopefully you'll figure the source, and then you may or may not be able to affect the change. And if you can't affect the change, at least you know exactly where to stay as far away from as far as your next antenna design.
Yeah, I think so. And also, I want to see if the signal, the transmission improves when I take these aluminum bars away with the extensions on them. I remove them. And then I put some kind of waterproofing on the conductor that is exposed. And then I put them away and see if the antenna improves once I get rid of those pieces of metal, the antennas that I don't use. And then I try, you know, to see if the noise will also improve. Go ahead.
Well, certainly more information is a lot better than less information. So I would believe that, you know, even if it turns out not to make any difference, at least you've learned that much about it. I don't really know if you'll get anywhere with it. It also depends upon how close these pieces of metal are. And different antennas will couple with each other if they're within the near field, which amounts to approximately a half of a wavelength of the signals that you're working with. If the other antenna is something like two or three wavelengths away from it, chances of it coupling and causing those types of problems are not really that great. But again, if it doesn't cost you much, except for a little time to do it, it's a good experiment, and you'll come to some conclusion, and you'll learn something.
The antennas are less than a yard away from each other. They meet in the middle, and they fan out one side. It's way, you know, from what I described to my friend, and he had an idea about this. First the phasing, and I told him that we have two antennas of the same frequency very close together. He said, it sounds like you got coupling. You know, can you remove one of the antennas? I'll say, I'll try and see what happens, you know?
WTA.
Yes, Joe.
Yeah, right. Don't forget me. I'm not finished with my questions, so I'll be on the side until you're ready.
I'm sorry, Joe, for the distraction, but we'll settle up with David and get right back to you.
AC2GS from KG2RY. Thank you. I think I got the answer to my question. Pass it along to the next person.
Okay, very good, David. And please, when you do your little experiment, come back and tell us how it all worked out. So let me once again throw out the same question that I threw out before that didn't particularly get answered. Does anyone out there who has any other experience with any other software-defined transmitter, transceiver type, have any comments about this question? Okay, Joe, the silence is deafening. So as I said before, with the software-defined radios is ICOM's 7300, the new 7610. There's a model from ELAD. There's SunSDR. And the two major players are Apache Labs and Flex. I prefer the technical, the hardware of the Flex radio. I would love if they got their act together and made the software much, much, much more powerful. They keep promising. Maybe someday they'll do it. I don't know. There's no perfect solution yet. You know, we'll have to just give it time, I'm afraid.
Okay, Dr. Roy. I'm sorry. I should have made clear. I was interested primarily in a receiver to augment the Ethernet station, something to use as a contingency during poor conditions. I think some time ago I heard Milan talking about an SDR receiver. And what's on the market today and what are the prices like?
Thank you. AC2GS. Okay, I misunderstood. The prices are all over the place. The low end are things called RTL dongles. They are based on a chipset for European television reception. They start at $25 and work their way up to about $50-$60, usually with the extra dollars they put in converters so that it extends the range of the receiver and shields it against RF. Milan has a SDR Play 1.0A, and I'll give him some time to explain how much he's having fun with it. ELAD also has a series of medium-priced SDRs. You know, at that point, it goes up from about $700-$800 up to $1,100 or $1,200. There's a company called Perseus, which I believe is in Italy, that also sells a very nice software-defined radio, that receiver, that goes for about $1,000. And I'm sure there's loads and loads. I mean, if you just do a Google search for SDR receivers, you'll see an endless stream, mostly of RTL version dongles, because they're so inexpensive that everyone has gotten into the market of selling them. But let me ask Milan if he could give a couple of points about his SDR play.
First, I want to make sure, do I sound okay on the repeater right now?
Yes, you sound fine.
Okay, thank you, because there's something strange going on with my antenna here. All right, well, I personally like the SDR play RSP-1 Alpha that was launched somewhat recently. And it costs $120 right now, or at least last time I checked. And it has a lot of features. It's up to 16-bit SDR, the receiver only. It has one antenna port, and it's powered by USB, and it comes with some free software, which is called SDR Uno. You can run up to 16 receivers on it with bandwidth up to 10 megahertz, but for best operation, really, it's up to 6 megahertz bandwidth, and it goes from 1 kilohertz kilohertz to 2 gigahertz, and it's made for shortwave listeners and for people doing amateur radio, and actually one of the very popular uses for it is to use it as a SDR receiver to another radio, and MFJ actually even in December launched a product that allows you to connect your antenna to one of their boxes that was traditionally used for transmit and receive switching, but they made an SDR version of that box. When you're receiving, it lets both your transceiver listen to the antenna and the SDR radio, SDR receiver that you're using. And when you transmit from your transceiver, it switches off the SDR from the circuit so it doesn't get overloaded. And it has sufficient isolation to do that with a 100-watt receiver, with a 100-watt transmitter. So that's a very popular usage of that specific SDR. And also, Roy, when we have time later, I do have some comments on the benefits of SDRs. That was a question earlier, but I couldn't join in to answer it at the time. So when you have time later, I would like to list some of the benefits of using an SDR.
Okay, very good. We'll hold that off until right before the TechNet puzzle, and it'll be a nice little addition to the to tonight's technical net. So, Joe, did we answer your question reasonably well, or is there any other aspect that you'd like further discussion on?
No, Roy. No, I think that Malen has the answer for me. As I understand it, that equipment is used in conjunction with a computer, either a laptop or a desktop. And if so, that would be great for me. It would be innocuous. I wouldn't have to camouflage it or cloak it in a piece of Heath Kit cabinetry. It would go very well. So, yes, that answer, you guys answered my questions tonight. I'm going to be on the side until the puzzle, and I'll be looking forward to hearing more of what Malen has to say about it. So this is KC2WTA with questions answered on the side.
Okay, Joe, very good. I just want to add the usual that software-defined radios are a technology advancing practically every day. So the information that we give today hopefully is pertinent today. A year from now, there might be newer models that have much better specs at much lower prices with much more flexible software. So it's one of those things that it's always a good idea to keep your finger on the pulse of this, because you know there's not going to be anything new about a super regenerative radio. They pretty much perfected it. It's a done deal. But silicon is a wonderful material. They're growing all kinds of interesting chips. So you never know what software-defined radio will look like, say, a year from now. So keep that in mind that, just because Malen loves his SDR Play, which is a great device, next year there might be even a greater device. So that's my two cents worth. Anyone else who has any questions or comments for the technical net at this time? Okay, I'll give you one more time. Anyone out there have any questions or comments or statements for the technical net at this time?
K2JVX, just listening and just checking in, but no comments.
Okay, thank you very much, Lloyd. So, Malen, I think it's time for your SDR presentation.
Thank you, Roy. Well, it's not really a presentation. It's just a few things I figured I'll say on the topic, since someone earlier asked about why go and get an SDR instead of something else. First of all, SDRs aren't limited to being controlled only by mouse and keyboard, as many people think, and can have other control surfaces integrated into the chassis, like a traditional radio, or even separate or remote from the main chassis. Modern SDRs are becoming increasingly interface agnostic and can work with several independent control surfaces. The traditional mechanical filters and DSP chips have been replaced with programmable devices and smart algorithms, They can do all the tricks of analog devices, but offer the opportunity for future software improvements after the radio has been sold to the customer. Let me drop. Kilo goes to Charlie. Also, it is almost trivial for an SDR manufacturer to introduce new features, UI enhancements, bug fixes, improved noise reduction algorithms, new operating modes, compatibility with other devices and equipment used in the shack. The best part is that it doesn't need to involve anything more than updating the software. This is just not possible with traditional radios where you typically have to buy extra parts or additional hardware to connect to it and even more cables. Also, the end user or some other skilled enthusiast can also introduce their own features or enhancements to an SDR. Their creativity is only limited by the nature of the software being used, open source code versus proprietary closed source. There are many examples of user-created add-on meters, UI enhancements like spotting network integration, memory markers on the spectrum, and waterfall. There's waterfall customization, macro buttons that perform several actions, often with several devices like a tuner, amplifier, router, in addition to the radio. Also, the hardware can be reprogrammed to perform the functions of other devices, like a signal generator, spectrum analyzer, antenna analyzer with a band plan, and graph, antenna phasing box, transmit and receive equalizers, voice recorder, signal enhancer, antenna switch, sequencer, and etc. And many SDRs are capable of interfacing with more than one software package as the client. This allows different groups to develop different features, algorithms, and solutions to common problems and needs. For example, my SDR player, SP1 Alpha, works with SDR Uno, SDR Console 2 and 3, AHD SDR, and possibly other software packages that I haven't even tried yet. Also, since the user interface is not fixed like in a traditional radio, the user could have different presets and configurations suited to different modes and operating scenarios. Imagine having one interface perfect for listening to a dozen shortwave radio stations, another for SO2R contesting, another for weak signal DXing, yet another for working satellites using transverters and Yagis with switchable polarization, several more presets for each digital mode, software package, and a bunch of saved, receive, and transmit equalization profiles for your extensive collection of microphones and headphones. I know I'm so bad at speaking tonight. Well, all these things are possible. That does not mean that they're necessarily implemented right now. And that's that frustration that Roy is talking about. There's all this potential, but these companies often are not very experienced in creating software, and it can take them a very long while to actually get around to doing these things. This is Kilo Golf to Charlie, and I'll give it back to Roy.
Very good, Milan. Thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions about that information?
KC2WTA.
Yes, go ahead, Joe.
The question was for Milan. Milan, could you give me the model number of the equipment you are using, just so I can have a starting point for researching this?
Yeah, sure. It is made by SDR Play, and the model is RSP1 Alpha. They came out with it in December, I think. It's $120 on hamradio.com and possibly other places. That's where I got mine. They shipped it, and I got it the next day or 2 days later, something like that. It's pretty fast shipping. But there's many other receivers. This is what just happens to be a recent one that has some good filtering on it and has nice software for listening to the ham bands and covers the frequencies I want. But there's cheaper receivers and there's more expensive receivers. So for some people that track weather satellites, the $10 receiver could be sufficient, like the RTL SDR dongles, for example. Or maybe if they are more interested in other frequencies, there's a slightly more expensive RTL SDRs with TCXOs, temperature controlled oscillators, and maybe some filtering and other features like capability for HF bands. So, you know, there's a lot of selection on the receivers. Transmitters, as Roy said, not so much.
Yeah, sounds good. It sounds like the answer for me for weak signal DXing and during full conditions. So, Milan, thanks very much. KC2, WTA, on the side.
Okay, anyone else with any questions for Milan on this subject before we move on? Your signal is very, very low. I can't make out your call sign. Whoever you are, if you have a power amplifier, if you have an antenna that you can point better to us, or move it around, or wiggle it, or jump up and down, try what you can do to get a better signal to the repeater. Now, I'm afraid you're not even capturing the repeater. You catch it for about a half a second, and then it drops. And I'm looking on my pan adapter on the input frequency, and it doesn't even make a little bit of a bump. So I'm not getting you on the input at all. So I'm sorry. Maybe some other night, better propagation, stronger signal. There are always amplifiers. Keep those in mind. Does anyone else have any questions to Milan about the subject of software-defined radios? And then I guess we will ask if anyone has any other questions at all that they would like to bring up on this TechNet tonight.
Charlie?
Milan.
Thanks, Roy. Well, I couldn't really understand Axel's question. I think the problem he has is not so much with the RF strength of the RF signal as much as his audio gain. If he increases the microphone gain, I might understand the whole question, or maybe you understood it. But I heard it is something to do with RTL SDRs. And I should mention, today I've heard three questions already about them, I think what I should do is bring my RTL SDR dongle, which I do have one. It's one of the nicer ones with the TCXL, so it's more frequency stable, and a metal enclosure to isolate it a little better, and bring my RSP1 Alpha to the next meeting, and maybe we can look at them as a presentation. So I'll try to prepare something like that, because I see there is interest in it, in cheap SDR receivers. Roy, so did you hear the question, or if not, maybe Axel could repeat it?
AC2GS. I heard that he was alluding to RTL SDRs. I think he was asking for a source to look into the subject and for possible purchase. I'll let Axel try one more time, hopefully putting up the mic gain, and just to see if he can transmit again and say the totality of the question. And if not, I'll give a little spiel, if I can, about RTL SDRs.
Okay, KD2 OVM again. Let me see if you can hear me well now.
That is much, much better. Is there any way to raise the gain any further? I'm a greedy guy.
I'll try to talk louder. Basically, the question is if it's worth it to invest the time. The money is nothing, $20 maybe, but the time in researching and installing and playing with those little devices, or just maybe go ahead for a higher level type of SDR. Those are receivers.
basically, they want to admit, I think. That's my question, basically. Where somebody that is, might be interested to get into the SDR, first try with those little toys, they are about $30, in order to, after that, go to a higher level SDR.
We'll go to Charlie. Yes, Milan.
I think it's worth it. Even if you go for another one, and, you know, that's what I did. As you said, $20 is not much money. The researching part, don't spend too much time seeing all the differences between those RTL SDR dongles. It's not really worth the time and the money to understand the hardware differences between them, as long as it's based on the RTL SDR platform, I would say. Because they're not that significant, and if you wanted a better receiver, you know, just spend something a little bit more for something nicer. But it is still useful to buy one and learn how to use it, because the software is much the same, basically. If you listened a little earlier, I listed a bunch of software packages, SDR Uno, SDR Console, HD SDR, and others. Well, I have used my RTL SDR dongle with SDR Console and HD SDR, and I know it works with others as well. So if you set it up with those packages and you familiarize with yourself with how that software works, how to change frequencies, select the bandwidth, apply the DSP filtering, work the memories, change modes, all of that stuff, you know, that knowledge is not lost. If you get a better receiver that works with those software packages, well, you already know how to use them, and you just get the advantage of a better receiver and maybe some new features, as better receivers tend to have switchable filters, for example, so you can filter out unwanted frequencies, not overload the ADC on the receiver. So it's still worth it, and you know, if you decide you need a better receiver than that, the old one can still be utilized. For example, you can listen to your favorite repeater with some small whip antenna without having to power on your entire radio, and you know, you just get more receivers that way. So that's my take on it. And also regarding your question on how do you learn a little bit about them, well, there's this website called rtl-sdr.com. They have a quick start guide. They have a lot of articles. They have an about page. They actually sell their own RTL SDR dongles as well. They have a store. And they'll point you to a lot of sources on the software and manufacturers. I would say the information there, if you get into it, could be even overwhelming. So get one and play with it, is my advice. Cable Golf 2 Charlie, back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. I agree with you entirely, Milan. I think, Axel, that you would have a great fun time. You're a tinkering type of a guy. You like to figure things out. You're not intimidated by computers. That's the perfect formula for something like an RTL SDR. What the website that Milan said is an excellent, very large website. So, I mean, you can kind of look at a few pages and settle there. If you want to look at every page, you'll have to kind of dedicate a month of your life. The guy who started that website published a written version of it called The Hobbyist Guide to RTL SDR. He's a guy from New Zealand called Carl Laufer, no relation to me. But you can get some insight if you want to do a search for it on Amazon for RTL SDR and read some of the comments of people, and you can pick up the nuances of the slightly different features. As Milan mentioned, some of them replace the questionable oscillator with a temperature-controlled crystal oscillator. Others have more shielding. Others have bandpass and preamp circuits, and others have up converters, because these dongles are not very good on HF. They shine on UHF and VHF because they were designed originally for digital television in Europe. So in order to get a good dynamic range on the HF frequencies, some manufacturers include a small up conversion device that just raises up the HF frequencies to a higher frequency that the dongle can better demodulate. But I think you'd enjoy the experience, personally.
Hello to Charlie.
82 OVM. Thank you so much, Roy and Claire, for the info. I'm going to look into it. And one more comment about somebody mentioned, I forgot the call sign, about web-defined radio. There's a very nice article that came out on the USC magazine, the last edition. A lot of information about how it's built, how it works, trying to servers, and very nice. Somebody has access to those magazines. Just go ahead and find the article and read it. Very interesting. Back to you, Net Control, Roy.
Very good. Thank you very much, Axel. I think QST is an excellent magazine. I would recommend it among amateur radio operators, even if they don't like to join organizations and are a little bit suspicious of national organizations, that it's worth the price just for the subscription. Let me turn it over to Malen, because I think he had something else he wanted to say.
Thank you, Roy. Yes, I remembered something else when you mentioned go and read reviews and comments about the features. Also, go look at YouTube videos. You will get so excited about what people are doing, because you will see them, manipulating the waterfall and pan adapter and different modes and decoding images from satellites, weather satellites run by the government, and listening to all kinds of interesting things. And you'll get so excited, I'm sure you'll buy one right away. That's what happened with me, basically. Back to you, Roy, from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Yankee 2, Michael Yankee.
Gene recognized. What would you like to say, Gene?
Good evening, guys. Question, by getting these SDR receivers, how are you guys getting the antenna for? Are you splitting the main antenna for your HF rig, or are you putting up additional antennas?
Does anyone want to say what they do? I mean, my SDR is my base transceiver, so it's hooked up to all my antennas. But, Malen, you can explain how you've hooked up your SDR play.
Yes, Roy, thank you very much. Well, there's several ways. First of all, people who are shortwave listeners, they don't have transmitters, so they just hook whatever antenna they can, very often long wire antenna to those. And actually, the SDR2 version has a high impedance port specifically for such antennas. Now, for those of us that are amateur radio operators, we have that concern you mentioned. How do you switch to it? And there's several ways. The cheapest way that does not require anything else is just change the coax between the two. Obviously, you cannot switch your coax very rapidly between your receiver and transmitter, so you're kind of be without receiving or transmitting for maybe up to a minute while you do that. So that's not really a great way. The second better way is to use a switch, just those regular mechanical switches. Like I have here a Daiwa CS20 switch, and I also have an MFJ1702C switch. Those are two-port switches, two ports on one side, one on the other side. So I have my antenna coming in on the one port, and the two ports between which you actually switch, one of them is to my transceiver, another one of them is to my SDR. So when I just want to listen, I set to the SDR. When I want to start transmitting, I set it to the transceiver. Now, there's an obvious disadvantage to this. Let me drop. The disadvantage is that you can't listen both on your radio and on the SDR. Now, you could set up your audio settings just so you can listen to the SDR and speak through the transceiver microphone and switch with your mechanical switch, but that's not ideal. So that's why companies like MFJ came up with a product. The product theirs is MFJ1708SDR. This little box has a very simple function. It has a port where you plug in your antenna, and it has one port for your radio and for one for the SDR. When you're receiving, it just splits the signal between the two. I think it might have some sort of amplifier in it as well, because I do see that it requires 12 volts DC on it. It has a push-to-talk relay, so when you transmit, it removes the SDR from the circuit, so you just you have a straight connection between your transceiver and your antenna. But at least when you're listening, you can listen with both the SDR and your regular amateur radio. I hope this answers your question. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
Yeah, answers, mostly answers. I kind of knew the answer, but I was hoping with those about magnetic loops. Are you guys also using magnetic loops?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's that possibility as well. Just have more antennas. You could have your one antenna for receive, one for transmit, or just one for your SDR, another for your transceiver, if it's a separate transceiver, or, you know, add more antennas. Actually, even the one I have the one alpha from SDR Play, but the SDR2 has several ports. You can switch between antennas, and Roy has many ports to switch between antennas and can even use them in full duplex mode where he listens on one and transmits on another antenna simultaneously, or he can listen to both antennas on several signals as well. So SDRs can do these things. Pretty often the hardware allows it.
That's very interesting.
Yes, on my 6700, I have two transmission output connectors. I have two receive-only connectors, and I can mix and match. And I have a magnetic loop, and it's hooked up to one of the receivers. And depending upon how I control it on the software, it can default in receiving on the magnetic loop and transmitting on a transmitting antenna, or you know, switch things around. So, you know, if you pays you money, you get to play with more toys.
Is your magnetic loop indoors or outdoors?
Well, my magnetic loop is outdoors. I when I first built it, I tested it indoors and was rather depressed because indoors it's really not good at all. Outdoors, I found it surprisingly good for what it is. You know, my magnetic loop is only 10 feet off the ground. There's an enclosed row of houses on either side. And it was better than my fan dipole when my fan dipole wasn't extended as far as it should have been. Once it got extended farther, it was my fan dipole that was much better. But still, magnetic loops are amazingly good for what they are and where they are. But I would not use them indoors.
What's the range of your magnetic loop, and what's the diameter?
The diameter is, they're all kind of approximately the same diameter that I've seen, especially the commercial ones. The average one usually is about 3 to 4 feet in diameter. Range is problematic. I mean, it's kind of like saying, well, what's the range of a fan dipole? It depends on propagation. If propagation is with you, then it's not a near vertical incident sky wave, if that's your question. It's not a local antenna. If propagation is with you, you can hear distant signals if they're trapped in the ionosphere, bouncing around and finally landing down near your magnetic loop. So it's not a toy antenna. It's an actual antenna. They actually do work. And they're compromises, but it's kind of amazing what you get out of this type of a compromise.
What bands do you cover with those?
Mine is specced. It has a low noise preamp that kind of decides what bands it can really amplify. It can go as far down as it's specced for 80 meters. I've used it to pick up broadcast band AM signals. So it depends upon the amplitude of the signal you're picking up. It's more of a factor as far as transmitting, because that's where the diameter and the amount of capacitance that you need to tune it for a acceptable impedance gets in your way. These antennas have incredibly high Qs, which means they have very narrow bandwidths where they're 50 ohm nominal. So if you even think about transmitting, you really have to tune it specifically for that frequency, and usually that's a power limitation because the capacitors used because of the high Q have to be gigantic or a vacuum capacitor. And so as transmitting antennas, the reason why everyone thinks of them as receiving antennas, as I do, is that transmitting antennas, they're usually very limited in their power. Now, there is an Italian company that makes this monster. I think it's Ciro is the name, and it's actually being sold in DX Engineering for the ridiculous price of something like $3,500, and that thing is built like a tank. So I wouldn't suggest you buy it, but if you're on DX Engineering's site, look up loop antenna, because it's an interesting thing to look at.
I was doing some research. I think about probably building one. I just want to know some more information if I have built one or any ideas.
Love to try.
Well, I know we have club members who have built loop antennas. We have a club member called Alan in the city, I think, who makes a lot of them. Unfortunately, I haven't heard him on the TechNet lately, but maybe he's there listening. If so, if he could give us a couple of pointers, that would be nice. I've never built my own. I simply bought it. It's now being sold at DX Engineering as well. I forget exactly what it used to be called. It was manufactured by another company that pretty much sold the shortwave receiver equipment. But DX Engineering bought the company out when the guy retired. But if anyone out there has built their own magnetic loop antenna, please tell us your experiences.
We'll go to Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
Well, I haven't built one, but I think you're talking about the Wellbrook loop, or maybe I think there was another one that was called Pixie or Pixel. I think it was Pixie. I know the Flex people use that one for presentations, and both of them are receive-only loops, and they have low-noise preamplifiers, so you don't use them to transmit, just to listen with those two antennas. But also, I wanted to mention, Ham Radio University had a presentation on building your own antenna. Mike Cosma, Whiskey Yankee 2 Uniform, was doing that presentation, and he will hopefully post his spreadsheet with all the calculations, but you know, if he doesn't, there's online calculators and also software you can download that will kind of put the frequency that you want to work, the power, the dimensions that you want to build it, and it tells you how it will perform, and then you can kind of adjust the dimensions until you're happy with the efficiency and the other parameters, then you go find parts to build it. But the one he built, I should mention this because it's a very easy base to find, which is not always the case. He used the hula hoop and then encased that with copper foil tape. Just wound it around the hula hoop, and then he put regular electrical tape on top. And he also did a matching section with a smaller loop, which he got some small styrofoam loop and put some copper tape around that as well. So that's how he built his. But he also used a butterfly capacitor, not a vacuum one, and he built it so he can withstand about 30 watts or so. And he put a small hobby motor on that one as well, so he could tune the antenna remotely, and he built a controller for that as well. Again, his call sign is Whiskey Yankee 2 Uniform, and he has some good information on how to do that. But if you just look online, there's a couple websites that are very detailed in this sort of stuff. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to you, Roy.
AC2GS, well, thank you very much, Milan. It's a Pixel Pro 1A, is what they used to call it. I don't know if DX Engineering keeps that moniker or just kind of sells it as DX Engineering's magnetic loop receiver. But it used to be a Pixel Pro 1A. And they were promising, I think, the 2A at some point, which was going to be twice as big, but that never came into existence. But, yeah, there's a lot of places for source material. Yahoo actually has a group where one of the guys actually manufactures, he tools the little butterfly capacitor plates, and every so often he sells off his extra to interested people to kind of build their own. And, you know, it's doable. It certainly is doable. Again, YouTube is your friend. I'm sure you'll find a lot of examples of people who stuck their coax cables together in a kind of Ouroboros, you know, a snake eating its head. configuration, and, you know, watch some YouTubes. It's all fascinating.
I've been watching some YouTubes, and there's some, like, 3 foot to some 12-foot diameter of the radius, and it's very detailed and, I guess, complicated since I'm not really that into antenna yet. Since I have my analyzer, I might as well learn and use my analyzer.
Yes, you certainly should use your analyzer. I would suggest if you're starting off with magnetic loops, to start off with relatively small magnetic loops. If you're so inclined to make them bigger, then so be it. But it's just a lot easier to make mechanically something with the usual 3 to 4 foot diameter. I wouldn't go wacky with an incredibly big one that's better suited for 160 meters.
So you mentioned you have it off 10 foot. That's off the backyard between houses. How far are houses, would the houses affect the radiation?
I mean, that's sort of the beauty of a magnetic loop. The houses are 20 feet in both directions. And a lot of antennas would just cough up a fur ball and just stop. But the takeoff angle of a magnetic loop is tolerant of even that nonsense. So whereas, you know, if I had to guess, when I was just putting it up, because I didn't know that much about antenna theory, I sort of amazed myself with the amount of signal I could get. So the takeoff angle, you know, as we were talking before about the impedance and standing wave ratios are all well and good, but there are other factors of antennas, and one of them is the takeoff angle. And it's suitable for magnetic loop. You don't have to worry about being blocked as much. You don't have to worry about reflected signals blocking you. It's a lot more forgiving than verticals or horizontals.
What about which way to face it? Does it make a difference?
Theoretically, magnetic loops are oriented along the direction of the loop itself. In other words, at the right angle to where the hole goes through. So it's not, if you're looking through the loop, that's 90 degrees away from the propagation direction. So it's in the plane of the loop itself that's the pattern. But I have found, for whatever reason, in my location, it's not terribly directable. I get roughly the same type of signal because I have a rotor hooked up to it, and I've rotated it many, many times and not really picked up any significant change in the signal strength.
Okay, greatly appreciated. Q Yankee 2, Michael Yankee.
Very good, Gene. Any other questions or comments for the net? Okay, just one more time. Any questions or comments or statements for the technical net?
It will go off to Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
So I figured I will mention what the catch with magnetic loops, because, you know, it's wonderful how small they are. It's wonderful that they can pick up signals even if you put them in your garden. You know, there's always some drawback to these things. And the drawback, in my opinion at least, is that when you transmit, the voltages on the transmitting loops can be very high. And I mean 5,000, 10,000, you know, voltages like that. So that's why if you want to do 100 watts, you might need a high-powered vacuum variable capacitor to do that sort of stuff. And those cheap ones, well, not cheap ones, because they're still like $300-$400 loops for transmitting. They're often rated at 10 watts or something like that. So if you want higher power, usually you have to build your own, and you have to build it very precisely, because you want to minimize the losses. That is kind of difficult to do with a magnetic loop to minimize losses. You can maybe easily do it on one band, but if you want to do a multi-band loop, it gets pretty difficult. For example, the loop presented at Ham Radio University, well, it was pretty efficient on 20 meters, and that was the loop from 40 through 15 meters. On 40 meters, I think he said that he has only 9% efficiency or something like that. And that's if you build it well, meaning all the connections are sufficiently good for the power that you're running and you're using the right high-Q capacitor, because if you don't use the high-Q capacitor, you're going to make things even worse. And also on those transmitting loops, depending on how you build it, or actually pretty much always, your bandwidth would be pretty small, the usable bandwidth. So you might have to retune a lot, especially if you try to use a very small loop. All of them are small, less than one-tenth of wavelength on the frequency that it is built for. But if you try to build to use, for example, the 42-inch loop that Mike Cosma described, that was built for up to 40 meters, if you tried it on 80 meters, well, it's kind of too small for that. So those are the drawbacks that I had on top of my head. Kilo Golf 2 Charlie, back to you, Roy.
AC2GS, very good, thank you, Milan. Basically, a magnetic loop, there are people out there who don't even like the term magnetic loop. Their attitude is it's simply a form of a shortened dipole with an inductive coupling feed line. And because it's a short antenna, as you decrease the size of an antenna, you increase the Q factor of the antenna. And when you increase the Q factor of the antenna, what effectively you're doing is narrowing the bandwidth so that it only tunes to a very small frequency range. And also the reflected currents and voltages are multiplied by that Q factor, which is where the incredibly high voltages come in. You know, the voltage that you feed to the antenna magnetic loop as a transmitter is not that terribly high. But if you feed it into an antenna that has a Q of, say, 2 or 300, it means that voltages of 2 or 300 times what you're putting in is getting fed over to the coupling capacitor. And that's a lot of voltage for a capacitor. And if you don't do it right, they arc, they burn, and they die. And this is the reason why vacuum capacitors were favored, because although expensive and difficult to find, they arc far less than air-based ones. And so they'll tolerate more voltages. So as a receiving antenna, they are very nice. As a transmitting antenna, they are problematic, in my humble opinion. Anyone with any further comments about magnetic loop antennas tonight? Okay, so let's go to the TechNet puzzle tonight. The question is a relatively simple text-based question. Overdriving a power amplifier will, A, give you a high standing wave ratio, B, give you a minimum distortion on your receive, C, generate excessive harmonics, and D, maximize the power output. Anyone want to come up and give me your opinion on which do you think overdriving a power amplifier will do to you?
Okay, we'll go off to Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
I think answer E, it's needed to be heard in Europe.
Okay, I'll have to put an E there next time.
Kilo Yankee 2, Michael Yankee.
Yes, Gene.
I will guess C.
Okay, anyone else want to suggest what they think the answer might be?
Alpha distortion.
Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo. I'll go with C.
We'll go to Joe, then we'll go to that other person that doubled with Joe.
Okay, I think everybody's going to be in agreement. The answer is C, and I say C because I once drove the RF deck from a Motorola Maritrack with an Alinco 6-meter FM, and I hit a repeater in Queens, and the owner of the repeater scolded me. So, oh God, you're all over the place. You need a low pass filter. So I would say C also.
Please tell me your opinion.
Okay, let me see if I have it. Net control?
Doubling with Joe. Please give me your opinion.
Okay, I don't know if that was that myself doubling or not, but let me see if I have it. Okay, net control? I'm going to also say generates excessive harmonics, C.
Okie doke. I think we have a... I think we have everyone kind of knowing the answer to the question. The point of the exercise is that the first answer gives you a high standing wave ratio, has absolutely positively nothing to do with the driving power of your power amplifier. It's a consequence of the impedance of your antenna system. Now, sometimes impedances shift a little bit when you go from low power tuning up to high power, but that's not quite the same as overloading your power amplifier. So standing wave ratio really doesn't factor into it. Giving you a minimum distortion on receive is a kind of a goofy answer, because it doesn't affect your receive in any way. It affects your transmission, so throw that out. And maximizes the power output. Well, you know, I mean, you could quibble with this type of an answer, because generally speaking, amplifier circuits are not amplifying as much as they can. So if you threw more gain into it, yes, you'd have more power output, but not necessarily. The ultimate reality is that these amplifiers are set to a certain gain because that gain is linear. Transistors and tubes and what have you all operate in different regions. They operate on the linear region, and if you overdrive them, they will go into a nonlinear amplification and cause a great deal of distortion and harmonics and side tones and just spurs that will filthy up the entire band and make you not a friend of anyone. Now, I don't know if you guys had experience with Citizens Band in the past, but my understanding is occasionally guys who really, really wanted to see that watt meter move. So they had their friends change the gain settings for the final amplification circuit, and sure enough, they were able to pour two or three times the amounts of watts than before. The signal was completely nonlinear. You could barely make out what these guys said, and unfortunately, you heard that garbled message all over 11 and some pieces of 10 meter. So as Joe pointed out, it happens to the best of us. Sometimes it's accidental. Sometimes, for some odd reason, people want to do that. So, yes, indeed, everyone is correct. Everyone wins the prize. The answer is C, generates excessive harmonics. Congratulations to you all.
KC2, WTA, net control. KC2, WTA.
Yes, Joe.
Yeah, Roy, do you or anyone on the net tonight know who operates the... 6 meter FM repeater, I think in Queens, and I think the prefix of the call there was WHH.
Yes, I know Howie. He frequents the Limark Technical Net a couple of times a month. I understand his repeater system. He has a multiple repeater system. He has repeaters that supposedly work on 10 meters, on UHF, on VHF. He actually once linked this technical net to his repeater chain. But I understand that his repeaters have been down for a few months due to power problems. He wasn't putting out the power that he thought he was, and he's still kind of figuring out what the hell went wrong.
Yeah, I was just looking for him on QRZ. I did walk that contact, but I was horsing, you know, when I first started in this, I was horsing around with a lot of stuff, and I was trying to hit a repeater in Albany, you know. So I got at this Motorola Maritrack and disconnected the input of the RF deck and coupled it up with this Alinco 6 meter FM. That is this RF deck should have been driven 1 watt. I was driving it with, I think, the 5 watts, and I was trying to hit this repeater in Albany that had the same frequency as Howie's with PL tone. Now, Howie's used no PL tone, so I was hitting that too, and he got on. He said, you're so full of harmonics. What are you doing with that stuff? I told him what I was doing. He said, oh, you do yourself a favor and you set up a filter for that.
Yeah, Howard is very professorial. He knows a lot of things. He's done a lot of things, and he has an opinion for a lot of things. I have a LP500 digital station monitor, and I'm able to actually put a power coupler on the drive from the transceiver and from the linear amplifier, and the circuitry in the device generates what's called a trapezoidal signal, which indicates whether you have a linear amplification or whether it's nonlinear. If it's linear, the trapezoid is a nice straight line, and as you overdrive your amplifier, that straight line starts to curve more and more. And if you really mess up, it becomes almost like a semicircle. That's when you know you're doing something terribly wrong.
Yeah, I pulled the Maritrack RF deck out of there, and of course he's in Queens, so I got to him with 1 watt, and he just now that's better. And now one more. He says one more question, Joe. What made you buy a radio on a band that's hardly used? I thought it was a valid question. That's because I picked up the receiver in Northern Virginia for $20, and I had already had a 6 meter antenna, and I was just horsing around with it. But yeah, six meter FM, not much going on that band in this place. But you know, that's what a dopey newcomer like he's capable of. You know, I was just showering the place with the harmonics.
Well, sometimes that's how you learn, by making mistakes and correcting them. And 6 meters will live again when the sunspot cycles return for us. And unfortunately, I know newbies who have done all kinds of unfortunate things without thinking about it. One gentleman was interested in, he was a technician license, and he wanted to try his luck on phone on 10 meters, so he bought this radio, only to find out that the radio only does FM. It doesn't do AM, it doesn't do single sideband. So lots of luck finding someone to talk to on FM on 10 meters. So, you know, again, you live, you learn, you waste a couple of bucks here and there.
Yeah, I haven't wasted too much money, though. I think I learned my lesson early. And, well, that's all I have to say. KC2, WTA on the side.
Okay, very good. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. Any other questions or answers or comments or statements for the technical net before we roll this all up?
We'll go to Charlie.
Yes, Milan.
Is that radio that you're talking about, the 10-meter FM-only radio, the Yaesu FT8900? Because it does 10, 6, 2, and 70 centimeters. And it has crossband repeat and full duplex, by the way, which is great for satellite operation and even a packet jack as well, if you're into that. So it can do great many things, but as you said, not really single sideband on 10 meters or, well, on anything really. It just doesn't have single sideband or CW for that matter.
Yeah, I think that was the model. I mean, yeah, the guy selling it to him didn't snooker him. I think he told him about the bands that it operates and the modes that it operates. I don't think he was particularly listening or it was quite connecting. And so it ended up that both parties kind of got annoyed, both with themselves, with each other, and with the technological world. And that's a shame because you sort of have to figure out what you want and then find something. There's a lot of wonderful equipment out there that does things that you really don't care about. So it's little point in investing in them. So find what you want and the best bang for the buck and have fun. So, once again, any closing comments, answers, statements, what have you, before we roll this up? Very well, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, February 7th, sometime after 7:30 p.m. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. as time allows. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This tactical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater KC2RC. If you can communicate using Fusion technology, please join in. We offer an audio stream of the Fusion Net on the Internet at fusion.kc2rc.com. Members, as well as non-members, are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. Keep in mind that an application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this TechNet or give us an idea or some topic that you would like discussed, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this TechNet, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. And keep in mind that next month's meeting for the club will take place at the Methodist Hospital in the old executive dining room, which I believe is being renamed the Carruthers Conference Room. It's between the gift shop and the cafeteria. So that's where we'll be meeting in February. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more and talk less. Well, it's time to roll this all up and shut this all down for now, but we'll be back to do it all over again on January 24th. And you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially to Malen, KG2C. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Good night, guys. Have a great time.
Good night, Roy. A great net, and I guess that's all from me for tonight. I'll stick around a few more minutes if anyone has any follow-up questions. Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Nice net, Roy. Thank you. AC2AE.
Nice night, guys. Very informative. Kilo Yankee 2, Michael Yankee.
AC2WTA. Yeah, thanks a lot, guys. We'll see you next time.
Everyone, 1984 BM.